Hello, everyone. Welcome to Future Melbourne Committee meeting number 7 here at the City of Melbourne. It is Tuesday, the 16th of March, 2021, and we're opening the meeting at 5:30 p.m. I welcome councillors, management and members of the public. Thank you for attending our meeting this evening. On behalf of the City of Melbourne, we respectfully acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which the City of Melbourne is gathered, the Bunurong, Boonwurrung and the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung peoples of the Eastern Kulin Nations, and pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We are committed to our reconciliation journey because at its heart, strengthening relationships between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal peoples has benefits for our city, our state and our nation. As part of our efforts to contain the spread of COVID-19 and pursuant to the provisions of sections 394 and 395 of the Local Government Act 2020, council and committee meetings will be held virtually until further notice. During the period 1 May 2020 to 26 April 2021, councils do not need to provide for members of the public to attend meetings in person. We are able to satisfy the public attendance test during that prescribed period by providing live streaming services. And this meeting is being presented via live streaming, and an audio and video recording will be made available on our City of Melbourne website by close of business tomorrow. We'll also provide the unconfirmed minutes of this meeting on our website as soon as practicable. Could we please all check that our mobile phones are on silent or turned off so that we can enjoy the repartee of this meeting and not be interrupted by telephone sounds. Thank you. The agenda this evening comprises 5 reports from management and 1 item of general business. We have an apology today from Councillor Louis, and we send him, on behalf of the City of Melbourne, our sympathies and condolences at this time. I advise members of the committee and the public that where the committee makes a decision on the basis of fewer than 6 members voting in favour of it, the decision may be referred by a councillor to council for decision. If any councillor has either a direct... If any councillor has either a general or a material conflict of interest as defined in the Local Government Act 2020 in relation to an item to be considered this evening, can you please disclose the type and nature of the conflict as the relevant item is being considered? Confirmation of minutes of previous meeting. Councillors, item 3, I am calling on a councillor to move a resolution adopting minutes of open meeting number 6 held on Tuesday 2 March 2021. Thank you. Councillor Griffiths and Councillor Chang is seconding that motion. I'm putting the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. It's unanimous, so we can declare that motion carried. Thanks, councillors. Are there any items arising from the minutes of that meeting that you'd like to discuss at this point? None. Thank you. The following submissions have been received in accordance with the council's governance rules. In relation to agenda item 6.1, which is planning permit application TP-2020-533, which is 6 to 10 MacArthur Place North in Carlton, we've had request to speak from Joseph Bernard, Constance Bernard, Mary Marasco, Olga Fisher, James Samargas, Hamish Balzan from Urban Edge Consultants, and John Cicero from Best Hooper. We've had items of correspondence from Justine Ullman, Dan D'Souza, Joseph Bernard, Constance Bernard, Lorenz Marasco, Ben Shaw, Dominic Fitzjohn, Helen Ullman, Mary Marasco, James Samargas, Jalila Sluti, Lillian Native, Merv Fennell, Jasper Meager, Janelle Farrelly, Rod Wood and Kim Hyun, Evram March and Tristan Chicato. Thank you for your correspondence and submissions this evening. In relation to agenda item 6.2, planning scheme amendment C396, finalisation of the heritage places inventory, we've had a request to speak from Wayne Coles-Janice. We've had an item of correspondence from Felicity Watson from National Trust and Wayne Coles-Janice. In relation to agenda item 6.3, submission to Infrastructure Victoria on Victoria's draft, on Infrastructure Victoria's draft 30-year infrastructure strategy. We've had an item of correspondence from Greg Day and also from Chris Thrum. In relation to agenda item 6.4, marketing support for activation in the city, we've had a request to speak from Wayne Coles-Janice and items of correspondence from Chris Thrum and Wayne Coles-Janice. In relation to agenda item 6.5, outcomes of City of Melbourne COVID-19 business support program, we've had a request to speak from Wayne Coles-Janice and we've had an item of correspondence from Wayne Coles-Janice. I'm advising submitters that you will be invited to address the committee at the time the relevant agenda item is considered. You have 3 minutes to address the committee. We like to adhere to the 3-minute limit. It makes it fair for everyone. And to assist you, there is a countdown clock on the screen that you should be able to see. When it gets to 1 minute, there will be a bell that rings to let you know that you're down to the last minute, and another bell again at the 3-minute mark. If you could please finalise your presentation at that time, it would be appreciated. Thank you. In accordance with the Council's governance rules, a 15-minute period is allowed at the beginning and at the end of every future Melbourne committee meeting for members of the public to be able to ask questions. We've received one written question today for this meeting. In reading out this question, I'm not attesting to the veracity or the factual nature of the question or any statements made. I'm reading it verbatim from Wayne Coles-Janice. And the question says, I note that reports to Council and FMC include a section dealing with conflict of interest declarations from staff and others involved in preparing a report. Can I suggest that Council staff sign a statutory declaration that confirms the conflict of interest rather than what appears to be a voluntary admission or declaration? The response provided by our Director of Governance, Michael Tonta, says that management of conflicts of interest is an important part of good governance here at Melbourne City Council. Both the Local Government Act and the Council's Employee Code of Conduct set out the requirements for identifying, declaring and managing conflicts of interest, and these are considered sufficient to provide assurance that conflicts are being identified, declared and managed appropriately. Wayne, thank you for your question. I'm now calling on the Deputy Lord Mayor, Nicholas Rees, to assume the role of Chair of the meeting in relation to the City Planning Portfolio. Thank you, Deputy Lord Mayor.
Thank you very much, Lord Mayor, and good evening. There are two reports from management for consideration under the Planning Portfolio this evening. The first of those is Agenda Item 6.1, Planning Permit Application TP-2020-533. For the property 6 to 10 MacArthur Place, North Carlton. I am conscious that there's been a lot of community interest in this application, so I'm going to ask our senior statutory planner, Larry Parsons, to please give us a short presentation about this item to explain the position of officers.
Thank you, Deputy Lord Mayor. Could I have the first slide, please? So the site is 6 to 10 MacArthur Place North. There you see it on the screen. It is two doors in from Canning Street. It has rear access off Nichols Lane. Next slide. The current buildings on the site, which are to be retained, they are contributory in an ungraded streetscape, which has a fairly diverse range of architectural styles. You will see that they have inconsistent balustrading, which will be replaced with something more sympathetic in the refurb scheme. Next. This is the form which went to VCAT previously. There was a previous application which was refused by VCAT. You will see that, number one, the new development starts right behind the second roof line. Number two, that it is of a very blank and voluminous style. And number three, note the height. The current process is also at VCAT because the applicant has taken us under Section 79 for failure to determine within the prescribed time frame. So if you move to the next slide, this is what is proposed now. You will see that behind the retained front sections, which are and two room depths, 9 metres, plus another 2 metres of terrace. That terrace space is new. There used to be a lift in that space, which is more dominant. The height has been reduced 0.8 metres approximately. There has been more articulation of the rear building without it becoming very sort of significantly attention-catching. You will see also that the chimneys are retained. All of the chimneys are being retained now. Next slide, please. From the other direction. So what you're seeing is the front gable roof is retained, and then the next hip roof behind that is retained, which has three more chimneys. Basically, there were three houses previously. There will be three apartments, one per floor of each of the heritage building extended to the rear, and an extra penthouse-style one at the third level at the rear. Next, please. This is the basement level, which is accessed via Nichols Lane. It has just three cars, which is now compliant with policy in terms of one per residence. It's a car lift, so the cars will go in, they can turn around, and they can exit forward-facing as well, so they will not be backing down Nichols Lane. Next. The ground floor. The front-free sections are retained. You will see a cutout between the projecting walls on the bottom two rooms. There's a condition to remove that. The top of the slide shows the new entry for all three apartments with the lift set further back than what it was previously. You'll also see the courtyard for that ground floor apartment and the car lift access at the rear. Next. The first floor has now an increased open space for that apartment, which occupies the whole floor. And there are some setbacks to the rear, to the what is the bottom right corner of the slide. Next. The top floor, or penthouse, as you see, is set back behind the two roof forms. There's that 2 metre terrace, and then the lift is set back even further beyond that. And you'll see some side setbacks to the south of the slide towards the house at number four. What has happened is the reduced height and the setbacks has meant that there is no additional overshadowing of the open space of those houses at the control times of 9 to 3 on the 22nd of September. Next. That top apartment has a roof terrace, which is accessed internally and has a low balustrade. Next. There you'll see the front elevation, the retention, and the replacement of those balustrades with a modern version of the typical format. Next. This is the rear elevation to Nichols Lane. The terraces to the right-hand side are well set back, beyond 9 metres, don't need screening. The window you see on the corner to the left has opaque glass because it is 6.4, I think it is, metres from the adjoining development across the lane to the north. Next, this is the west side elevation. As you would have noted in the slides previously, it adjoins what is a car park for the Elgin Street building. What has changed dramatically here is there is now an articulation in terms of ins and outs and different materials to give visual interest to that west facade, which is at present with the opening visible from MacArthur Place. Next. And that is the other side to the east, showing the setback to the top floor and the opaque glazing. And you'll see above that the low parapet for the indented roof terrace, providing their public open space, their private open space. Next, and that is finally the lane, the where the green is on the left-hand side of the slide to the rear is where the new garage access will be. The light pole will have to be removed. There is a condition to achieve that to council satisfaction. There are a number of bins along the lane. Two properties have at the moment permits to have those bins on the lane. The other ones don't. There will have to be some manoeuvring with those bins with the cars coming in and out. As I said, they will be front, forward driving always and driving very slowly. So that completes the presentation.
Thank you very much, Larry. Are there any questions for Larry? I certainly have one. I think one thing we can all agree on is that MacArthur Place, both north and south, is one of the best corners of our city. One of the features when you drive up and down the street is there's obviously some of the beautiful heritage homes and the heritage brickwork and bluestone that comes with those homes. I notice in the heritage report, as part of the officer's report, there's reference to the possible removal of the non-original render and paint to reveal the original intact brickwork and bluestone elements. In your view, would that be something that would be reasonable to include as one of the conditions as part of the officer's recommendations this evening?
Yeah, it is not obliged for the application and this permit, but it certainly would be a positive feature which could be considered. And it would, obviously there might be the need to do some remedial work and depending on what they uncover, but it's certainly very feasible.
Right, thank you for that, Larry. Any other questions for Larry? All right, in that case, thank you very much. And I will now call on Joseph Bernard, who requested the opportunity to address the committee in relation to this matter, to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome to Town Hall virtually, Joseph.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Joseph Bernard. I'm an owner of 5557 Elgin Street. I'm here today to plead with the council to reject the application for off-street parking via Nichols Lane. I ask you to consider the safety of our residents and of the greater community, which includes thousands of cyclists that use Canning Street corridor every day. Nichols Lane is unique. At the entrance of Canning Street, of the lane, is the Canning Street protected cycle corridor. Any vehicles wishing to enter or leave Canning Lane need to cross this bike lane. Vehicles will have to negotiate cyclists travelling downhill at speed or alternatively try to push through bikes that are banked up waiting for the lights to change during peak hour. Note that there are occasions where the vehicles must back out into the bike lane, that cars do back out. It is reasonable to claim that this gravely impacts the safety of the protected corridor. This is a fact that we've been unable to impress upon engineering services to date, and the council's report fails to even make any mention of that other than it's an objection. It's fair to say that this intersection is a black spot, and I'll bring to your attention the recent reconfiguration of the lane to improve safety that supports this claim. Last Friday, I submitted a detailed report that attempts to, you know, lay out the facts, but if you really want proof, I invite you to just try enter Nichols Lane at peak hour with a car and then try to reverse out back into Canning Street. It's a street, people will be entering that lane and will be reversing. And then take this and gauge for yourself the absolute gravity of the potential consequences that are at stake here. We, the residents of Nichols Lane, are currently living the dream of a pedestrian-friendly, cycle-centric transport model. council's approval of the vehicle access will extinguish this reality and disadvantage the current owners, residents who rely on the lane, and the cyclists who then have to deal with the convoluted manoeuvres that vehicles make when it frankly puts lives at risk. Please note that the council's engineering report fails to answer many of the objections, fails to acknowledge any of the safety issues reported, fails even to mention the risk to cyclists. Safety does not appear to be in the decision matrix for the approval. I know that this council values safety because of the policies it promotes. It looks like the council's engineering services do not see this vision. Voting to deny this application makes it clear that the cycle lane and pedestrian access are more important than a few parking spots. Please vote no. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joseph, and delighted to hear you're living the dream. And thank you for, as you said, and thank you for your submissions. What I might do is at the conclusion of submissions this evening, we'll come back and address some of the specific concerns being raised. So I've heard you loud and clear the points you made about cars entering and exiting Nichols Lane there. Our next speaker is Constant Bernard. Welcome, Con, to Town Hall virtually. And mind you, please speak for no more than 3 minutes.
Thank you, Councillor. Since the first application in 2018, I've read all the council plans, policies and strategies, and it's clear that the council's objectives are to provide a safe environment for pedestrians and cyclists and to encourage alternate transport. 25 people who use this lane multiple times a day are trying to tell the council that encouraging vehicles to cross a busy bicycle lane into a tight space with property frontages, bin storage and outward opening doors within 300 mil of sole access and emergency exit points to homes for 7 minutes while they wait for a hoist is extremely unsafe. On paper, possible, but it's certainly not upholding the purpose of 52.06 of the planning scheme, because this will adversely affect pedestrian amenity. Also, the unique factors of Nichols Lane predate the planning scheme. Asking us to undo them is impossible. From 18 years to 25 years, all Elgin Street owners predate this space being scooped up in 2004 and added to the roads management register, even though owners continued to maintain it. If it was assessed individually at the time, it would have remained an easement. Allowing three cars sets a standard, and with development of other properties, there is a potential for this to become 13 vehicles. There is little chance of pedestrians or cyclists getting priority, and we end up pre-80s where instead of having a comfortable outdoor space and ever-increasing foot traffic, it ends up an undesirable environment with ever-increasing cars, which will in turn affect the quality and duration of tenants, rule out tenants with disabilities or children, and result in a high number of altercations. Slide B, please. Engineering's reports have been factually incorrect.
About the properties, there is a potential for this to
Engineering approved the development with six parking spots. VCAT correctly ruled that council had not done a thorough analysis and the allowance was overruled. However, they also ruled, and I quote, whether it can be achieved technically is a matter to be resolved by the council and the other affected owners. The council's ignored all correspondence from the owners to date because its unique circumstances do not fit into the narrow planning guidelines and critical thinking is not being employed. It's also clear that the consideration of pedestrians and cyclists are not in the planning or engineering's decision process. Road safety is not mentioned anywhere in the planning report, and how can road safety be taken into consideration without anyone attempting to understand the function of this space, which is the core element of Austroads local area traffic management guide, which I urge council to adopt. In your words, council's mission is to make people feel safe. The only way for safety to prevail in this circumstance is to restrict all vehicular access on this easement and install a bollard. Alternatively, when an incident does occur, whose fault will it be? This needs to be used by the residents. It doesn't need to be a hazard for the residents. Thanks, councillors.
Thank you, Constance, for the points you've made, and again, we'll address those at the conclusion of presentations this evening. I'm now going to call on Mary Marasco to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome to Town Hall, Mary.
Thank you. I am one of the 66 objectors. I want to talk about the biggest problem, height and bulk. This development is too high and too bulky. At 11 metres, composed mainly of concrete and glass panels, it will affect heritage. Height and bulk was one of the many issues raised by VCAT, but not answered in this TP application. Planning objectives say that developments must fit in with the existing neighbourhood character. In our case, MacArthur Place is heritage, with 84 properties facing onto the park, mostly finely articulated terraces. 80 of them, 95%, are single or two levels typically being about 7 metres high. In contrast, this development is 11 metres high. What about new extensions tucked behind the 84 properties? 100% of extensions either match the height of their existing terrace or their neighbours, or they're lower. They fit in. Of the few cases where the property was completely replaced, it's the same. They either match the height of what was there before or the height of their neighbours' terraces. That's 100% fitting in. In contrast, this development is 11 metres of concrete and glass panel bulk sitting behind its timber terraces, much higher than all its neighbours and its own terraces. Higher than all the neighbours... Oh, could you show image one, please? Could you show image one? Thank you. Higher than all its neighbours, this development will stick out like a sore thumb. Even more, because the site is unusually exposed. To its west is a vacant lot. To its east, the Canning Street view, is a section of 4-metre-high walls, highly exposed in the development. Could you show the image two, please? We took this developer's similar application to VCAT in 2019. I quote VCAT member Rachel Naylor. Just because a maximum building height is specified, she refers to 11 metres, does not mean a proposal can automatically build to that height. A key question from a neighbourhood character perspective is whether this proposal fits in with the existing valued character. And I am not persuaded that the proposed upper level, in particular, fits in the scale and form of surrounding buildings, which are part of the characteristics of the neighbourhood. So VCAT member Naylor says that just because a guideline states 11 metres doesn't mean you can do that. She also calls into question the suitability of the third level. A development must fit in. The 66 objectives want developments to fit in. Councillors, as our elected representatives, represent us and support developments only that fit in the existing valued character, and reject this application. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mary. I now call on Olga Fisher to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome, Olga.
Thank you, Chair. Dear members of Council, my name is Olga Fisher and I'm property owner at 55 to 57 Elgin Street. I would like to voice an objection to this development, especially the off-street parking access via Nichols Lane, as we owe a duty of care to the families and business that rent our properties. To put things into perspective, Nichols Lane has been reclassified as a roadway, but it has never been used as one. And its reclassification has been done without any consultation with the local residents. Nichols Lane is only 3.5 meters wide, not the required 5.5 for a standard laneway. It's fully enclosed by fences and has always been used for pedestrian access only. To access the frontage to our residential units, which have no other entrances. Also, if Nichols Lane is treated as a roadway, then for the months of construction period, the laneway will be used by heavy equipment and machinery, and there will be no way for the local residents to access their properties, rendering them uninhabitable. This is also includes the loss of emergency exits from our properties. So our properties, in effect, would no longer comply with the building code. Nichols Lane is too narrow, in my opinion, to be shared by people and vehicles. There is no room to maneuver, and pedestrians, especially on a wheelchair or with a pram, can become trapped by a moving vehicle. Likewise, a reversing driver, for example, you would reverse if you had to give way maybe to another person in the lane, will have no visibility of a child or a person in a wheelchair moving in the lane behind them. The traffic engineering report simply says the laneway is short, safe, and cars will move slowly, as its justification for allowing local traffic. But it makes no mention of having to reverse out of the lane and offers no analysis of how our people and vehicles are to share it. Likewise, the safety of cyclists on the laneway and on Canning Street is not even mentioned. In all our discussions and questions regarding safety, the standard response from the councillors' engineers has been that this laneway is a road, which is historically and in practice has not been so. It's only with the approval of this project that Nichols Lane will become a road for vehicles. I'll ask councils to please reject this application and vote for the safety of our residents. That's all from me. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Olga, for taking the time to address us this evening. The next person requesting to speak was James Samagaris. James, welcome to Town Hall. Please be reminded you're asked to speak for no more than 3 minutes.
Thank you very much. My name's James Samagaris. I live at 20 MacArthur Place in Carlton on the same side as the development. The back of my property has a second-storey room and a terrace in front of it, which gives me at the moment an uninterrupted view of the two-storey building that's on the corner of Canning and Elgin Street. What's proposed, I think, is not preserving heritage values, but is actually going to erode heritage values. It's going to give me now a view of a concrete wall, which is going to be a third storey and then a rooftop of glass. I don't consider that what was put in the presentation, that this is somehow not attention catching. It's completely attention catching. It produces a new building, which is the third storey penthouse, which has absolutely nothing connected to three single terraces that currently exist. It's a new floor plan format and it floats in the sky. It's going to be very visible. It doesn't make any reference to other houses in the square. I think that we have to look at the built form having this a visual effect and also an aesthetic effect on the senses. The MacArthur Square has been described as, you know, a very important sort of jewel in Carlton. It's not grand or imposing. It doesn't have imposing houses such as Watton House in Murchison Square. It's not a square like St Vincent's Place in Albert Park with a very imposing and grand Rochester Terrace. This is a square with small buildings, even if there are some two-storey examples. What happens with this development? It produces a unified three-frontage effect at the rear of the building. I really don't like that, and I think aesthetically it has an effect on the senses. It actually reduces the calm effect of the square, and I think that's a very important thing to consider, and that's a very important part of my submission tonight. It's a calm space for any city dwellers. Residents and other people who walk through really love and respect the square. It's an oasis of calm. It's very important that this historic heritage area is retained with the scale of these smaller buildings surrounding it. It's one of the first suburbs of Melbourne with that effect. I'm very concerned that all this will be ruined by large and bulky developments in backyards. And I ask the council to please keep the character of the neighbourhood intact. Thank you very much.
No, thank you, James, for your submission this evening, and we will respond to the points you've made shortly. I now call on Hamish Balzan from Urban Edge Consultants to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome to Town Hall, Hamish.
Thank you very much. Our office acts on behalf of Priya Sumathan and Tom Redmond, owners of number 4 MacArthur Place North, located immediately east of the subject site. So we're going to summarise our key issues as follows. So the first one is visual bulk, scale and massing. And we argue that the proposed form, including the three-storey section, would impose unreasonable visual bulk, scale and massing onto our client's rear property, courtyard, as well as a fine-grained character of MacArthur Place North. Of particular concern is the second floor bedroom at the rear north, classified as apartment 3.1, which extends deep into the site directly opposite our client's courtyard. This concern regarding extent of built form that goes to the rear of the site was raised by Council's Urban Design Department, which noted the detrimental impact this three-storey form would have on the adjoining properties as well as the streetscape. While the Council officers have sought to mitigate these concerns by an additional setback of 300 millimetres, it is contended that this does not go far enough and that this section of built form should be removed entirely where it is adjacent to our client's courtyard. This would require an increase in the setback from this northern boundary to apartment 3.1 at 3.7 metres. The second item we wanted to raise is in regards to overshadowing. So the shadow diagrams as shown on drawing TP00A7 are not an accurate representation of the overshadowing impacts on our client's property at 2 and 3pm. The plans have overcompensated the shadow cast on the 2.7 metre wall where there is more sunshine in our client's courtyard at the equinox than the diagram suggests, and photographs have been provided that show this. Without this detail and the scale provided, noting that the scale has been provided at 1 to 350, which doesn't allow scalability using a scale ruler or normal software, it's very hard to assess the true impact. As it is known, the previous application showed the shadow diagrams at 1 at 100 scale. Without this detail and with the errors in the diagrams provided in the permit application regarding the shadow cast by the existing wall, it is not possible to understand the material detriment which may occur to our clients. So the other items we wanted to raise has been covered off with regards to waste management, but we just wanted to summarise by saying we argue that the application has failed to resolve issues raised by Council and BCAT in its original application and is still trying to squeeze far too much on the site at the expense of existing amenity affording to adjoining residents and the prevailing fine-grained neighbourhood character. We respectfully request that councillors take on board the submissions made and refuse the application or require additional conditions to address visual bulk overshadowing and waste management. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Hamish. I now call on John Cicero from Best Hooper to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Deputy Lord Mayor. It's Beck here from Council Business. I'm going to beg the indulgence of Council. We have a participant who has joined with a...
Sorry, we're having trouble hearing, so if we could just work on that technical issue and obviously start the clock again once we do have a proper connection.
Deputy Lord Mayor, it's Beck. Can you hear me?
Beck, we can't hear you.
Well, that's tricky. Oh. I'm going to unmute a participant who I think is our next speaker. Please bear with me. So the speaker who has joined under the screen name MSD at home, who do we have there, please?
Yeah, I mean, if the applicant has sought the opportunity to make a submission, we should do our very best to hear from them. So hopefully we can resolve those technical issues. Just wait a moment.
Is Council able to hear me?
We can hear you loud and clear. Is that John Cicero?
If not, I will apologise for John Cicero. John can't make the meeting. My name is Joseph Toscano, and I'm the architect for the proposal. John Cicero has asked me to step in on his behalf and late notice this evening, if that's okay.
That is perfectly okay, Joseph. Your 3 minutes starts now. Welcome to Town Hall.
Thank you. Look, the premise of this proposal from the outset has been to consolidate the existing buildings on site and to reconfigure the heritage fabric and streetscape to its original colonial Victorian style. And we're doing this by reinstating the identity of the buildings and setting back the third storey of the additions well behind the roof forms of the three existing buildings. That was something that was picked up on the original application. This current application has increased the setbacks, lowered the buildings to further reduce any perception of an overwhelming form to the existing buildings and from the perception of view from the square. So as you'll be aware, and as noted in the delegate report, the original proposal went to council and to VCAT in 2018-2019. The refusal at the time noted non-compliance to a number of planning matters, and I'll just summarise them quickly as follows. Heritage considerations, built form massing and articulation, failing to respond to neighbourhood character, overshadowing the two properties to the east, private open space concerns, and excessive car parking. So now, if we just refer to the summary report that you have as prepared by council, the current planning applications directly responded to all of these matters. And of course, I'd commend you to refer to the project assessment and summary outlined in the council officer report. And in particular, the Clause 55 report and detailed analyses, which has been undertaken by council. These analyses generally show that all of those issues that have been deemed to be contentious or non-acceptable back in 2019 have now been satisfactorily addressed. Neighbourhood character, site layout and building massing, general compliance with site coverage and permeability, amenity impacts, including the overshadowing issues, on-site amenities, including daylight to open windows, size of private open space. The detailed apartment designs, including accessibility standards, minimum storage provisions, energy, water, natural ventilation, they've all been addressed. Finally, I would just like to highlight to council that we've taken the opportunity to review the comments made by the heritage consultant related to the 2018 application. The current design now reflects the outcome of the built form and heritage design changes developed to respond to the earlier heritage comments. We now have an outcome which has received broad heritage approval. On the basis of the detailed design changes now documented herein and consistent with your council officer summary and report and recommendations, we request this committee assessment to support this application. Thank you.
Thank you, Joseph, for presenting to us this evening. Can I ask you a quick question as an architect? You'd probably be aware that the property has a non-original render over it, which obviously covers the original brickwork and bluestone elements. What would be your attitude towards a development which actually removed that non-original render and thus making a feature of those heritage brick and bluestone elements?
Okay, so can you hear me again?
Yes, we can.
Good, great. Well, look, to be honest, we hadn't picked that up on that detail until the heritage consultant had nominated that some weeks ago, a couple of months ago. Certainly, there is an opportunity if there is existing brickwork to reinstate. I wouldn't have a problem with that at all. The state of the walls at the upper parapets would indicate that it wasn't original brickwork. And I think that we would probably defer to the heritage architect who was our project consultant. Bryce Rayworth was involved with this project, remains involved with this project. And look, I would like to defer to Bryce as the heritage expert in this matter, but I think that if there was an overwhelming outcome that we should be doing that, I'm sure that the property owner developer would be more than happy to consider such.
All right, thank you, Joseph, for taking the time to present to us this evening. Much appreciated. Larry Parsons, we have heard a number of issues raised in submissions this evening. I'd invite you to respond to them, and as part of your responses, a couple of things I'm particularly interested in hearing your views about. The first was we heard from Joseph about cars cutting out across the bike lane on Canning Street there, which is indeed a very busy bicycle lane, in particular that they'll have to back out and that could cause safety issues. We heard from Constance about safety in the laneway, particularly given it's a narrow laneway. We heard from Mary about issues around height and bulk and it not matching the existing buildings in the street. I'd also ask you to address the point made by Olga around the Nichols Lane being reclassified as a road without consultation, with the, I think, suggestion being that that was something that was done in an invalid way, and that the Nichols Lane is indeed too narrow to be classified as a roadway. I'd also just ask you to address James's points about this being a highly, very visible, aesthetic impacting development, which is inconsistent with the street and his enjoyment of his property. And then also the points raised by Hamish around the, particularly that second floor bedroom that overlooks a courtyard and only has a 300 millimetre setback under the conditions recommended by you. And then finally the points raised by Hamish about overshadowing and the claim that the shadowing diagrams that have been relied upon in your report are indeed not accurate. So if you could just address those points, Larry, that would be appreciated, I'm sure, by all councillors.
And firstly, to talk about the laneway, the cars do not need to back out. One of the key aspects of the garage is that it has the possibility to turn the cars around internally, so they will enter the car lift frontwards, enter the lane, enter the car lift front facing, and they will come out facing the lane and then drive front facing down the lane to Canning Street. When they get there, there is a wide footpath, as we have seen. They will have to have care, of course, but there is not a blind spot in terms of the bike lane in that sense, which is why our traffic engineers were comfortable. They were also at pains to point out that it is three vehicles. We have many more shared spaces in our city which have many more vehicles than that and managed to work successfully. The fact that it is narrow has some advantage in that people will be going slow. So on balance, it was considered a reasonable and safe outcome that there is pedestrian and car activity together. The engineers also said that the chances of two cars wanting to go and use that lane at once are very remote with the three vehicles. And I understand there may be some loading or service access from some of the Elgin Street properties occasionally, but that can also be accommodated. In terms of the roadway, yes, it is a roadway, legally speaking. I can't tell you when that happened and in what circumstance. It has been some years. We tried to check back but couldn't find the exact details, but it certainly is a roadway, which means that the neighbours have the right to access, including for vehicles, if it can be done safely. What else? In terms of the height, it is not quite true to say that it is 11 metres. It is actually, the new part is actually 9.9 metres from the footpath level in the middle of the site. And there is, and that is 11 metres back from the street. And then a further 2 metres back is the parapet of the, or the balustrade of the rooftop terrace, which is about 1 metre high. So including that, it is 10.9, almost 11 metres, yes, which is legal. As I've said, that balustrade is set back further and it is, I understand, metal panels and maybe some glass. What else? The rest of the street, particularly on the north side, does have a variety of buildings. There are quite a few two-storey. There are some modern buildings. There's a modern three-storey apartment block. The buildings to the rear on Elgin Street, there's three-storey buildings there as well, so it is somewhat of a transition down towards MacArthur Place. It is a mixed context. And very importantly, from a planning sense anyway, it is an ungraded streetscape, so there is not an expectation that new additions will be invisible. So it's been assessed on that grounds, and it was our assessment that the current architectural treatment is an improvement, and a significant improvement over what was proposed at VCAT previously. There are indeed some increased setbacks to the east side at the rear where the neighbour's open space is. The most of that house is two stories against the boundary, so that it has no real impact. It is the rear section. As was pointed out, the shadowing diagram showed no impact at the control times on that open space. We'd be happy to receive any information which suggests there could be any error in those. I think that was the main issues. Do you have anything else on the list, Deputy Lord Mayor?
You've covered height and bulk generally. I was interested in your view on the specific point made by Hamish about the second floor bedroom and the 300 millimetres. I think the submission was that there should be a further setback.
From the east boundary?
I believe so, yes. Into the courtyard, yep.
Our assessment shows that that is not necessary in terms of shadowing or overlooking. And the glass is not at that point. The glass is in the further setback section, further to the north.
Okay, and then just finally from me, I just want to know that councillors can have absolute confidence in the shadow diagrams that are being relied upon in the officer's report.
We can only check them as far as we can with what is provided to us. We don't have a model to be able to check that ourselves. So that's why I say if anybody has any other evidence to the contrary, we're happy to review it.
Okay, so my understanding is that shadow diagrams are submitted by the applicant and they're required to do that through a certified process so that, you know, somebody can't manipulate the shadow diagrams to their advantage, that they are actually certified.
They are certifying themselves that they are correct, and it would be, you know, a disciplinary action if they are producing something which is patently not.
Okay. That's good to know. You had me a little worried there for a moment there, Larry, but that's good to know. All right. Were there any other questions for Larry before I put a motion to councillors? No. Okay, in that case, I'd like to move a motion which should be being brought up on the screen now, and this is a amended motion to what was proposed by officers, and I'm giving councillors a moment to read that and looking for a councillor to second it. Thank you, Councillor Leppett. And I'll now speak to this item. I guess the starting point in as councillors assessing this application is for us all to note and acknowledge that indeed MacArthur Place is one of the most sought after addresses in the city of Melbourne. It's an absolutely sublime location with that beautiful heritage park with exotic trees and lined on each side by, well, church at one end and heritage homes all around it. This particular application before us this evening does indeed have a long history. It's been before VCAT and it's been in our planning system here at the City of Melbourne for over 3 years, which is you know, not a great advertisement, it's got to be said, for the planning system and the approach that's been taken. I also note that there were 66 objectors. That's certainly a number which catches the attention of councillors, and so for all of these reasons, this is an application which has been, I think, very thoroughly reviewed by officers and certainly very closely scrutinised by myself and by other councillors I know. The particular location of this site is in general residential zone Schedule 1, GRZ1. There is a heritage overlay, HO1 Carlton Precinct, and there's a parking overlay, Schedule number 12. And the application itself does cover what are currently three townhouses, and the proposal is for them to be converted effectively into three apartments. It needs to be said that there have been very significant changes that have occurred to this proposal from the original application, an application which went to VCAT, and what we see now before us does involve a reduction in height, a very significant increase in the setback. It was certainly notable to me that the setback from the street is around or over 11 metres. The chimneys on the original townhouses will be maintained, which I think is important in maintaining the heritage character of the area. There's been some removal of openings into external walls, which I think we judged, or rightly been judged, as being inappropriate. The overshadowing that will occur as a result of this development, while I've heard the submissions made this evening, the overshadowing is compliant with the relevant planning provisions, and the overlooking from this site onto other properties is also compliant, noting that there is screening that has been incorporated into this design. There is an additional recommendation which is in the motion which is on the screen, and that goes to the non-original render and paint that is on this building. And I want to thank Councillor Olivia Ball for her investigation of this matter and pursual of this particular item, and I hope that she will speak to this in some detail in a moment. But the recommendation that's been put to councillors is that the non-original render and paint should be cleaned, and that should reveal the original intact brickwork and bluestone elements, which when you walk along MacArthur Place, as I've done many times, and in fact did over the weekend, I think that will reveal the three townhouses in all their original glory and add to the streetscape along MacArthur Place North. In terms of the laneway, Nichols Lane, we've heard a number of submitters tonight on that, and look, I do very much understand and sympathise with the points that they've made, but I think it needs to be said that this has been classified as a road quite clearly, and the safety issues which have been raised, I think ultimately this is a proposal which has an acceptable level of safety that comes with it. So, look, all taking all these factors into account, I certainly know that the residents, or many residents who have heard from tonight, and the 66 submitters, I'm sure, will probably not be happy with the recommendation which is on screen, but I do hope that they will come to see, particularly with the original brickwork and the investment that's going on into this site, that I do hope that this will come to be seen ultimately as an enhancement of MacArthur Place North. To the applicants, I need to be really frank here. I do wish that you had heeded the early advice that was made by the City of Melbourne on this application some 3 or more years ago. If you had heeded the early advice of the City of Melbourne, we would not have had, a VCAT proceeding. We'd not had all the expense that had resulted in. We would not have had all the time and effort which a large number of people have had to go through, and instead we probably would have found ourselves in exactly the same position we now find ourselves here this evening some years on. So I would put it to the applicants, and in fact I'd put it to all developers who are putting submissions to or applications to the City of Melbourne, to just bear in mind that here at the City of Melbourne, we do know our patch, we do know our local community, we do know our rules, and we encourage you to work with us. And if you do work with us, we will get to a better outcome in terms of your building application, we'll get to a better outcome for the community, and we sure will save everyone a whole lot of time, a whole lot of expense and a whole lot of effort, and achieve ultimately a better outcome for the community without the delay, without the expense, without the waste of time and human effort. On that note, I'll invite Councillor Leppett to speak to the agenda item.
Thank you, Deputy Lord Mayor. I certainly agree with those remarks, especially the way you've characterised the process at the end there. It has been a long process and difficult. I too conducted a site visit yesterday, in fact, not over the weekend, and apologies to any of the local residents who are wondering what I was doing snooping around Nichols Lane. There's quite a few issues with this application that we've been written to about and which need to be considered by the delegate and by us in assessing the application. I want to open with a positive, and that is that the heritage outcomes here have the capacity to be an improvement on what we currently have. Obviously, the properties have been let to be in a poor state as far as reflecting what the original state of the buildings would have been. And with the retention of the principal parts of the building, with some additional conditions here, and I want to thank Councillor Ball as well, but you as well, Chair, I think we have the opportunity for a building that goes back to what those significant heritage values were all about for these three townhouses, and making a really solid contribution to the streetscape and retaining a lot of that heritage fabric. This is entirely in line with our heritage policy. These aren't individually significant buildings, they're contributory buildings, and the extent of retention of those buildings, I think, is appropriate. The height and bulk of the building has been discussed, and whilst it's obviously true, you can look at the original application that went to VCAT and you can look at this application, whilst it's obviously true that the applicant is doing what they can to put as much as is possible in this market to turn the three houses into three apartments that will be as appealing as possible to future buyers, and that does mean putting as much bulk into the property as possible. It is appropriate. I mean, this is Carlton, this is not the outer suburbs, and the variations from standards that we're seeing here when it comes to site coverage, when it comes to setbacks from the side, when it comes to sidewalls, are entirely normal for this part of the city, and we shouldn't be balking at that. I think that the approach from the architect on this proposal, certainly not the proposal that was refused, but on this proposal, we don't have grounds to refuse. It should be supported. Parking, of course, is the trickiest one, because parking does not need a permit. We need to be really, really clear here. The off-street parking does not need a planning permit from us. And Nichols Lane is a public highway. The permit triggers are the heritage demolition and building two or more lots, dwellings on a lot. And of course, if you can't physically get a car up the public highway and into the property, then you've got a problem, and we need to look at how we can condition away from that. But this has gone through our engineering services team. This has been very carefully considered by the applicant. And if I lived abutting Nichols Lane and saw this application, I'd be extremely nervous about it as well. Don't get me wrong. But the off-street parking does not need a permit, and in this role we need to be facilitative and recognise that there is a public highway there, and I think the car stacker with the ability to always be driving forward is the least worst option. The better option would be if the rules were different and we could say that actually you probably can't put off-street car parks on this property, but we don't have that option. Off-street car parks don't require a permit if you've got three. Finally, on traffic and safety, as a cyclist and one who has proposed the Canning Street lane improvements myself, I accept that wherever you've got a crossover, you've got a conflict point. But that in and of itself is not a reason to refuse a potential future development. The permit may or may not be acted on. But if in future the traffic movements in and out of Nichols Lane means we need to tweak the way that that now very wide bike lane interfaces with Elgin Street, and we need a new bollard or a polymer concrete barrier in the road that helps cars coming in and out of that laneway understand that they're not to go into the laneway, then they're to cross it safely. So be it, you know, our experts in the city can deal with this. But we've followed the VCAT reasons for refusal and made sure that all of those issues that were identified have been overcome. I know that objectors are arguing that the reasons for refusal have not been overcome and that there are quite a few confusing matters here. There are also issues here that people are asking us to take into consideration that we simply can't. Loss of view and changing property values aren't planning considerations that we can consider. But on balance, were we to argue at the tribunal that it should be refused, that would be quite a waste of our ratepayers' funds going towards legal counsel to mount that case. This is a proposal that on balance should be supported. The key permit triggers there have been met, I believe. And finally, I just want to give a shout out to the professional integrity of all of the internal referrals that were relied on for this application. Referees, the engineering services team and others, but also to Ryan, our delegate, given how confusing and complicated the application has been, there's been quite a lot of scuttlebutt around the objectivity of this process. I think a lot of that has been unfair. Everything I've seen in this process suggests to me that the integrity of the process has been followed quite closely. And it has been a very objective and professional process. And this is a very thorough and comprehensive report. And based on the expert advice, we actually really only have one option here, and that is to support the issuing of a permit. Difficult though that will be for many of the locals to understand. This is actually a high quality development in a part of the city that does support this type of development. So I will be supporting it. And I thank our delegate for his work on making this recommendation to us.
Thank you very much, Councillor Leppert. Are there any other speakers for or against the motion? Councillor Ball.
Thank you, Chair. I just simply wish to speak to this particular amendment we have to all the other conditions that are before us. It's a very special part of Carlton. I understand why the residents cherish living on this beautiful square with some beautiful heritage homes. These three terraces are sadly neglected, and I do hope that at the end point of this process, the facade will be an asset to the square. We cannot ask for reproduction or reversal of any loss of heritage features to the facade, but we can, as the heritage advisor in this report, if I refer you to pages 49 and 50, I think, ask for the developer to remove the unsympathetic paint on the original brickwork and bluestone in these heritage properties. That will make it of a piece with the houses on either side, which are of contributory and significant heritage value, particularly the polychrome, beautiful double-storey terrace at number 14. Maybe the developers will reveal some polychrome decorative work in these three terraces. We can only hope that that is what was originally intended and will be revealed, and that ultimately it will be an improvement for the facade. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Ball. Are there any other speakers for or against this motion? In that case, I'll put the matter to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hand. And I've got to cite everyone. I'll declare that carried unanimously. The next agenda item before us is agenda item 6.2, Planning Scheme Amendment C396, finalisation of the heritage places inventory, and I need to declare a conflict in relation to this item due to my employment at the University of Melbourne and, in fact, two University of Melbourne buildings being affected by this amendment. So I think I pan back to you, or go directly to you, to the lead of the heritage portfolio, Councillor Leppert.
Thank
Deputy Lord Mayor. We'll just wait for the Deputy Lord Mayor to leave the chamber. And I'll be chairing in my capacity as Deputy Chair of the Planning Portfolio. And as the Deputy Lord Mayor said before he declared the conflict, this is Agenda Item 6.2, Planning Scheme Amendment C396, finalisation of the Heritage Places Inventory. Would councillors like a presentation on this item? No, in that case, I will call on Wayne Coles-Janis, who requested the opportunity to address the committee in relation to this matter, to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Wayne, over to you.
Thank you, Chairman and Lord Mayor and councillors. I just would like to have addressed my submission that was sent to you today. What kind of support is the Melbourne City Council proposing to give to maintain heritage buildings within the City of Melbourne? Because at the moment, it seems that we have lost a great number of our heritage buildings, and this is lamented quite often in social media. But the reality is the maintenance costs increases with the age and complexity of the buildings, and the Melbourne City Council seems to market heritage buildings and laneways quite heavily, but the onus of supporting the maintenance of these buildings is left up to the owners and tenants largely. And I would like to ask the Melbourne City Council to enact a levy or fee on contemporary buildings over six or so stories to assist in the higher maintenance cost of heritage buildings and the amenities of laneways and street fronts where they are found, to help show these heritage areas and remaining buildings in Melbourne, particularly CBD area, in their best light. Thank you.
Thanks, Wayne. While that question might be out of scope of the amendment we're about to consider, we do have our Director of City Strategy here and General Manager as well, and I might ask Emma Appleton to talk about our broader heritage conservation programs and answer your question. Thank you, Emma.
Thank you, Councillor Leppin, through you, Chair. Thank you, Wayne, for your question this evening. We agree that the heritage buildings are enjoyed by the broader community and have been considering different types of incentives to assist owners with the restoration of heritage places. We've not specifically considered a levy, but we'll add this to our possible range of options. We also fund Melbourne Heritage Restoration Fund, which assists owners with the costs of restoring heritage properties in the municipality. There are two streams to this fund: a responsive stream, which is open for all contributory and significant places in the municipality, and the Landmark and Community Buildings Fund, which provides significant funding for iconic or landmark buildings in the municipality and those owned or managed by community organisations. There is more information about these funds on our website, or we can arrange to speak to you about this following the meeting.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Emma. We'll now move to the debate, and I am going to propose a motion that's slightly different to the one in the papers, and I'll call for that to come onto the screen. There it is. It's longer than the recommended motion, but I will now move that motion and I call on a councillor to second the motion. Thank you very much, Councillor Griffiths. In fact, I'm just going to pause while we also look at the second page of the motion, just so that everyone's clear what we will be debating. Thanks very much, Jody. All right, so the Heritage Policies Review and the gradings translations and updating our inventory and all of the related parts to that behemoth of a proposal, of a project, has been going for many, many years. But this amendment is going to finally pull together our heritage inventory into one complete document. It means that our heritage policies won't be in two parts, part A, part B. We will have one set of heritage policies for inside and outside the capital city zone, and that remarkable project will be completed and our thousands of heritage buildings in the City of Melbourne will have contemporary nomenclature for their gradings, significant contributory and non-contributory, and meet the expectations not just of the state government and the heritage profession, but of our community. And this amendment is important to make sure that we do complete that update process. It cleans up the last nearly 400 or so buildings that were question marks from the C258 process, if I can put it that way, and required a second round of testing with an exhibition. But it is the minority of buildings overall that fell into this category. The debate as to why we needed a second amendment certainly has already happened. Now that we've got this second amendment, I hope that we can progress through this process as transparently, accountably, but as quickly as we can. And I welcome everyone to make a submission when it does go out for exhibition, and I hope the Minister approves exhibition as quickly as we can. The reason for the slightly different motion than the one on the papers is simply because we don't release the agenda papers to some submitters but not others before it goes on notice, because that would be procedurally unfair. But what we have done since the papers were published is receive feedback from those who have a broad heritage advocacy remit, whether it's across the whole municipality, the National Trust, and thank you to the National Trust for their excellent submission, or Melbourne Heritage Action, or the residents groups, or others, and say, this is coming up. Can you make sure that this area is right for you? And it is a wonderful way of getting that triple checking of everything just before we come in to make sure that the exhibition version is just right. So the tweaks here at 9.1 really are procedural. We're making sure that everything that should have been picked up is picked up. But these are 0.1% changes in the scheme of things. They shouldn't be alarming for that reason. All we're doing is making sure that everyone who's identified any procedural issue that needs to be identified before we get to the exhibition has had the opportunity to do that. And so I thank everyone who's engaged before today, and I encourage everyone else to get engaged during the exhibition process. Councillor Griffiths.
Thank you, Councillor Leppert. It's always a little bit intimidating to be following on from you on planning and heritage matters. I know you don't mean that to be the case at all. You've been very generous with your knowledge. This document has been a really useful opportunity for me to familiarise myself even more with some of the many issues that we need to consider at the City of Melbourne when we're making account of planning and heritage matters. Thank you to everyone who's been part of the work that's led up to this document being produced. As Councillor Leppert has said, there's been an enormous number of people, both inside council and external to council, who've spent many, many hours going through the document to make sure that it's of the highest possible quality. And a big thank you to everyone who's been part of that. I, just like some of the councillors in regard to the previous motion, took the opportunity over the weekend to take some walks around the city, subject my 9-year-old son to some walks around the University of Melbourne, to learn some of the heritage and history of that area. And I think it's sort of fascinating to see in a document like this that there are places that were very familiar to me when I think of the Veterinary and Agricultural Sciences Building and what is now the Peter Hall Building, buildings that I would have walked past hundreds, if not thousands, of times without appreciating the history and the heritage value of what's occurred inside those spaces. I shared some, but not all, of the history knowledge that had been made available to us through this document with him, particularly in regards to the Peter Hall Building. And then again, after that, looking around the Kensington area and revisiting again streets and cityscapes, buildings that I was very familiar with, but perhaps I'd never taken the opportunity to stop and consider just the differences that some of them presented. And in doing that, it caused me opportunity to rethink what it is that's valuable about some of those streets like Bayswater Road and others in the local area. For all of those reasons, if it can be educative to me as someone who is who's passionate about this area, well, it can obviously be educative to a great many more people across the municipality who want to make changes, always for the positive, I'm sure, for the city. And so it's been a wonderful opportunity to take some time to look at the document. And in closing, I suppose I'd just note the correspondence from the National Trust. It's always great to have a positive response come in, and they're more than just supporting what's in the document. They're going so far as to commend the City of Melbourne for progressing this important work. So I would thank them for their commendation and certainly share that with all of the people who've done the work to make this document a reality.
Thank you, Councillor Griffiths. Any other contributions to this item? No, I'll just close by thanking the team for the thousands of hours of work. This is not a simple process, given the complexity of the heritage of this place, which Councillor Griffiths has just done a much better job than me of explaining why it's important. So we'll close there and I'll put the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. I declare that carried unanimously. Thank you. We'll invite the Deputy Lord Mayor back and I'll hand over to the Lord Mayor to chair the remainder of the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Leppert. And as the Deputy Lord Mayor makes his way back in, we are going to consider item 6.3, which is the submission to Infrastructure Victoria on their draft 30-year infrastructure strategy. There we go. Welcome back. Agenda item 6.3. Councillors, would anybody like a presentation on this item? No, thank you. Then I'm calling on a councillor to move this motion. Deputy Lord Mayor, thank you, and a councillor to second this motion. Councillor Leppert, thank you. Over to you, Deputy Lord Mayor.
Thanks, Lord Mayor. Look, can I begin by acknowledging the terrific work of Emma Appleton and Richard and others in the team around this submission. Infrastructure policy is a very challenging area of policy making, not without controversy, because there's a lot of competing interests. And I want to commend the team for a very well-considered, evidence-based submission. In speaking to the motion that is on the screen, I'd also, I guess, like to note the importance of what is before us. Infrastructure Victoria, of course, is the Victorian Government's preeminent infrastructure advisor. This is a 30-year infrastructure plan. The last time something like this was undertaken by Infrastructure Victoria was back in 2016. So it is a significant undertaking by Infrastructure Victoria, and it's fitting that the City of Melbourne should be making a submission. The second thing I'd like to just note is that the submission by the City of Melbourne, in fact, draws on a vast body of work that's been undertaken by the City of Melbourne over a number of years and considered by councillors and approved by councillors through this forum and through council. So things like the COVID-19 reactivation recovery plan, the transport strategy 2030, the climate change adaptation strategy refresh 2017, the waste and resource recovery strategy 2030, the affordable housing strategy 2020, and so on and so forth. And so this submission that is before us this evening draws upon the recommendations from those earlier reports. I would also like to just draw to the attention of councils or remind them that this matter did indeed come before us at FMC on the 16th of February. And there was a resolution on that evening that we request management to prepare an updated submission, which importantly distinguishes between short and long-term goals for Melbourne. And I think that was a wise thing for councillors to do, because in making a submission at the time that we are living in, at a time when the city economy is, you know, at one of its lowest ebbs in the city's history, we need to be mindful of the short, medium, and long-term impact of recommendations that we are making. And I am very, very pleased to report that the amended submission, which has come before us this evening, does indeed take into account those short and long-term goals and is responsive to the current environment that the City of Melbourne finds itself in, while also acknowledging the well-considered long-term goals and ambitions that we have for our city. It also, this updated submission also provides qualified support for some initiatives based on a need to act on them once the recovery from COVID has occurred, or in some instances requires further analysis to be undertaken. And again, I think that's entirely appropriate, particularly for some things like the free tram zone, which I know has been a source of some attention and debate. In terms of, and most importantly, some of the very significant highlights which are in the City of Melbourne submission, I think we just need to keep reminding people of this till the cows come home, that the central city of Melbourne is indeed the engine of the Victorian economy, and the development of the central city is absolutely crucial to the health of the entire state and indeed the nation in terms of research, education, high productivity, jobs, innovation, and Australia's most important business cluster. The submission strongly supports investment in infrastructure to ensure that urban development in some of Australia's largest and most important urban renewal precincts can continue. And I'm thinking here specifically about Fisherman's Bend, Arden and Macaulay, all areas that we must see reach their full potential in the years ahead, particularly as Melbourne and Greater Melbourne resumes its population growth trajectory, which I'm sure that it will. Some of the key projects that are identified and must be prioritised by the Victorian Government in terms of major transport infrastructure include the Melbourne Metro 2, a tram bike walk bridge to Fisherman's Bend, flood and integrated water cycle management, green and blue infrastructure in buildings, protecting of the Yarra River Birrung, and new measures to encourage appropriate housing to address the current housing crisis. Next, the submission emphasises the need to continue to support and develop the existing central city, where much of the future city growth and Greater Melbourne's growth can be accommodated. Something that was of particular interest to me was the emphasis around the transition to a new energy grid powered by renewable energy. It also encourages a bolder approach to address more affordable housing across metropolitan Melbourne, something which has been much debated in this chamber before. So taking all those things into consideration, this is a motion which I'm happy to support and commend to councillors. Councillor Levitt.
Thank you, Deputy Lord Mayor. That's a comprehensive reason why we definitely should be adopting this submission, so I'll try and be much briefer than I was on the last two debates, but I too would like to thank Emma and her team and the entire leadership team here at the City of Melbourne for consolidating the wealth of policy that we have at the City of Melbourne into this submission. The Infrastructure Victoria 30-year plan is massive. It is one of those rare opportunities where you get to see a Victorian government policy, even though it's arm's length from the Victorian government, of such scope and boldness and ambition, and be able to say, that's great, but let's go further. So whether it's on transport pricing or housing or renewable energy networks, there is a lot in here that we should be amplifying, and in the hope that we can translate that into political will at the state level to implement some really, really amazing ideas that are coming through in the Infrastructure Victoria 30-year plan. But I think with our submission, we are making that plan even better for all the reasons that you said, Deputy Lord Mayor. I think that this is a really exciting time for a couple of issues in particular: transport, user pricing, the ability post-COVID to reprogram, reschedule the city to incentivise the use of our different modes of transport and our different transport systems in less congested ways, if I can put it that way. That is for the benefit of everyone, and that is a much more sustainable way of planning connectivity in Melbourne and Victoria than the traditional ways we might have done so in the past. If we can work with this strategy and amplify it, as I said, and translate that into some political will at the state level, the opportunities for not just the city of Melbourne, but for greater Melbourne and economic prosperity in this state are absolutely profound. But I believe that all the other areas where we're suggesting that we push a bit further and ask that this strategy go in even more detail, whether it's on housing or the other issues that have been mentioned. This is a really, really solid submission, and I'm very proud to be putting Council's name and mine to it as well. So thank you to everyone involved.
Thank you. Are there any other speakers to this motion? Councillor Lelou.
Thank you, Lord Mayor, and... first and foremost, want to thank the team for, I know it's a very comprehensive document, and again, thank you for the work that it's not easy collating all the information and also, I guess, the different feedbacks and everything. So that I just want to lay it very much at the front. I will support this. Because, look, there are elements of it which I think can be, as Councillor Lepp said, amplified. For me, fisherman's bend, I always say, it's a crime that we still have not activated, and the economic benefits that we can come out of that. I grew up in Shanghai, and I saw the growth of Pudong on the other side in literally... what has now become, and mecca of economic powerhouse, and I just see that we could do that for also Fisherman's Bend, and I would hope that the state government also take that same level of interest that we have in Fisherman's Bend, because for me it's it is something that I think it's really needed, and it's a good way for us to get out of COVID. In the COVID recovery. I also note that 30-year infrastructure strategy. So I first and foremost, I also want to thank Infrastructure Victoria for, giving us the insight the other things that the support that they have given us in terms of where they're going with this. I think, when you're talking about a 30-year infrastructure, you have to be future-looking, and a lot of what we have in here addresses some of that. For example, the gig economy, and also the our input in there, where we've support the regulation of automated vehicles and e-scooters, e-bikes, and everything. I think that's quite important, because, to be honest, we don't have anything right now, and it's so hard to control and regulate. And I think, it's one of those things that the state government really needs to get right, and we have a leading role to play in that. And I think it's good that it's highlighted here. Free tram zone, I'm very much, I think everyone knows my view. I've always said we should increase it to as far as we can. I would say increase it to the edge and border of City of Melbourne. But again, that's something that I personally would. But look, overall, there are stuff that I am very supportive of. There are stuff that I probably would need a lot more convincing about. But nevertheless, again, thank you for the team for pinning. And please, I'm gonna pass that on to the team, because I know it was a hell of a lot of work, and I don't want to take anything away from that.
Thanks, Councillor Lelou. Any other speakers to this motion? Then I will put it to the vote. All those in favour of this motion, please raise your hands. It's unanimous, so we declare that motion carried. Thank you. We move on to agenda item 6.4, which is marketing support for activation in the city. Councillors, would anybody like a presentation on this item? No, thank you. We do have a speaker to this motion, and I'm going to call on Wayne Coles-Janice, who requested the opportunity to address the committee on this item. Over to you, Wayne.
Thank you, Lord Mayor and councillors. I must say, after reading the report and living through the lockdown in close proximity to other traders and businesses in the CBD, I'm very disappointed that the report does not use the opportunity to present actionable information, and it seems to be a feel-good type of report that's to reinforce the retail shopper aspect of public funds being deployed without detail. And more importantly, details on where there are areas to improve in the deployment of public funds to support businesses within the CBD. I note in particular that there are 39% of unsuccessful applications, and I can only assume that this represents a large number of sole traders, artists, human rights organisations and companies in areas that have not received any support in the first wave of for businesses in the city. This has been acknowledged both at a state and federal level, and we all acknowledge that given the impact of COVID, that there was a need to deploy funds and support businesses and stimulate opportunities at that time. And there was always the caveat that we would go back and review and look at how these forms of support were being implemented and how that could be improved. 12 months after COVID has impacted on us, we have not had that review. I'd like to ask the Melbourne City Council what their plans are to ensure that all funding and spending of public fund is equitably distributed to all businesses and use the current opportunities to create a better Melbourne to visit. The report was heavily focused on shopping and retail, and they quote figures of, which I won't go into the detail, but we know that some retail operations, large chains such as Coles, Harvey Norman, Officeworks, JB Hi-Fi, McDonald's, etc., who weren't closed down, have benefited largely from being able to trade during the COVID lockdown period, which begs the question of what about the businesses that weren't able to do so? I would also like to ask the Melbourne City Council, given its interaction with the state government and the $100 million that's been allocated towards reactivation, to take these issues to the state government to ensure that funds are going to local projects of companies of various sizes and in various areas of operation. I think that there's not time to go into my submission to the council in detail, but I really would like to ask the council to ensure that there is more support for businesses in the Melbourne City Council area other than retail, shopping, coffee and eating.
Thanks very much, Wayne. And I think you've provided a very broad submission there that picks up a number of items, some of which may be relevant to this particular agenda and this motion and perhaps the one after as well. I think the gist of it is that you're looking for reassurance that we apply our funds equitably and in a manner that has impact right across the economy. And I think at this stage we are best to note your comments in that regard, and ensure that we address those in both this item, the next one, and in fact all items, and there are the many different ways in which we are supporting businesses across the city. You'll see some of those items just about every week on our agenda. In relation to discussions with state government, they happen daily, whether it's the $100 million city recovery fund or many other initiatives where we partner with the state government, and we will continue to advocate for the ratepayers of Melbourne and for the ongoing success of the city economy, which is an engine room for the state economy and a major contributor to the national economy. I think if we have if you have any other specific items, you mentioned that you've got other parts to your submission, we're happy always to read those or to receive other questions from you. Wayne, that might be more appropriate at the start and the end of the meeting, or else submissions in relation to these particular items. Thank you very much for your contribution, your interest. We're going to look for a mover to this motion. Councillor Campbell, thank you, and a seconder to this motion. Seconder, Councillor Deutsch, thank you. Over to you, Councillor Campbell, thanks.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. And can I also thank Wayne for very pertinent questions. There are, as you've identified, Lord Mayor, a number of items on tonight's agenda relating to the city's economic recovery. For the purposes of this item, it has a particular marketing focus, but some of the issues that Wayne has raised, I do think are raised in the next item, 6.5, so I might address them further there, and I would certainly welcome a submission from you, Wayne, or further questions, so we can provide a more fulsome response. And thank you, Lord Mayor, for your response. In relation to this item, it is so clear that the return of visitors to our city is the single most critical thing we can do to get businesses back on their feet. We want to remind Victorians to return to the city to enjoy all of the things that we've missed so much over the last year. The world's best restaurants, shopping, bars, galleries, and all of those small businesses that make Melbourne such a vibrant and livable place. And we know that we need to support our small businesses at this critical time to keep them on their feet and to aid their recovery. We know that every visitor helps keep our businesses' doors open, and it saves jobs. As JobKeeper comes to an end, we know that this support is going to be more vital than ever. That's why the Melbourne City Recovery Fund has contributed $5 million to marketing the support and reactivation and recovery of our city. And I want to thank the team for the work they have done under incredibly difficult conditions, and also take this opportunity to note the impact that work has had. And I want to talk about one particular initiative. The Urban Blooms campaign that was rolled out resulted in over 54,000 people making a visit into the city specifically to see our streets brought alive with flowers. Those visitors didn't just come into the city, they had a positive impact on our businesses, with each of those visitors spending on average $131 at our city's businesses on food, shopping, drinks. It delivered a total economic impact of over $7.7 million, a vital boost to our businesses in the most tangible way possible, increasing foot traffic. We know that so much more needs to be done. And part of that is that our city is going to require ongoing and sustained marketing support to get our visitors back. The City of Melbourne must continue to work with the state government to obtain ongoing financial support so we can continue to deliver the campaigns that bring visitors back to the city and support our businesses. We know that we need to use every lever at our disposal, and that doesn't just include funding, it includes council assets. And one of those, perhaps the most prominent, is the banners that line so many of our city streets, because they're the way that we all know and visitors know about the festivals and events that are bringing our city to life. So this motion proposes that from March to June, we will waive the higher fees for these banners, because we know our events industry has done it tough. We know that visitors want to know what's going on so they can support our businesses. And we know that vents bring this city to life. They play a critical role in reactivating the city. And we want to make sure every visitor knows about the events and festivals that are bringing Melbourne back. We know that Melbourne's back. We want to spread that message because we know every visitor that comes back into the city makes a real difference to keeping our businesses' doors open. It makes a real difference to saving jobs. And we know right now, with JobKeeper ending at the end of this month, it matters more than ever. That's why I commend this motion.
Thanks, Councillor Campbell. Councillor Deutsch.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Thank you, Councillor Campbell. Yeah, congratulations to everyone involved in the city's marketing strategy. Working with uncertainty is one of the most stressful things that we can face in our jobs, especially when considering the importance of the strategy this year in its support to the reactivation efforts. But I don't just want to mention the negative press, you know, and speak negatively about COVID and all of that and the need to bounce back. But I wanted to note some of the recent conversations that I've been having with local businesses, residents and visitors to our city. And they've all been incredibly wonderful and positive conversations, especially many I've had over the last week at some of the events we've been lucky to attend. And I'm sure a lot of people noticed, and I think I've mentioned this to a few of you already, that there's been a buzz in the air. I feel like Melbourne's really starting to get back on its feet and people are starting to come back in together. I mean, our stats aren't necessarily saying that, but there's that kind of joy that we're feeling again. Attendance is improving and it still has a way to go, but it's really reassuring. And, you know, I think that's testament to what Melbourne is capable of. Something I've learned over the last few months as well is that, you know, this buzz I was talking about, you know, the events and all the wonderful things about Melbourne and, you know, why we come into the city and we eat at restaurants and we have all this amazing life, it's not something that's telepathically, like, advertised to people out there. And I think for a lot of my time living in this city, which is my entire life, I've kind of taken that for granted. And, you know, the last few months having been on council, it's really opened my eyes to the amount of effort and intelligence and thought and research and hard work that's put into our marketing strategy. So, you know, I kind of want to apologise in a way, but also recognise and say thank you and congratulations. Well done to everyone involved in our marketing team. It's incredible, and I hope the officers know that we recognise that, and I'm sure the community of Melbourne recognises that too. So thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Deutsch. Any other speakers to this motion? None? Well, I'm going to. Thank you to Councillor Campbell and Councillor Deutsch for your remarks. I'm also supporting this motion. As we've said, every single event, big or small, plays an important role in bringing back the buzz to Melbourne. Every single initiative element, lever, that we can pull at the City of Melbourne, big or small, can play a major role in how our events industry can remain afloat and then become more buoyant as we go forward. The health and robustness of our events industry, the people and the organisations that actually deliver events in our city, can't be underestimated in terms of its significance to our city economy and what they drive for our culture, our reputation, our global standing. So I did want to acknowledge also the resilience. I know an overused word in many ways. If I could think of another one, I would. But the resilience of our events industry, their absolute determination, and the fact that they have remained so focused on the future and providing suggestions and feedback to us during incredibly difficult terribly difficult trading period is something we really appreciate, because it just demonstrates again your dedication to this sector and to the future of this sector. Of course, that feedback has been collected and considered by our team, who I know feel personally connected to this sector and its success as we do as councillors. So thank you very much to the team. There are some great suggestions in here, and of course, part of the report
is noting that there is still more work to be done as we continue to go through every element of how we can make a difference as an organisation for this important sector. So for those reasons, I'll be supporting the motion this evening. All those in favour, please raise your hands. It's unanimous, so we can declare that motion carried. Thanks, councillors. That brings us to agenda item 6.5, which is the outcomes of the City of Melbourne COVID-19 Business Support Program. Councillors, would you like a presentation on this item? No, thank you. And we do note the comments made earlier by Wayne Coles-Jenis. Thank you. And we've got another question. It might be the same or another presentation from you, Wayne. Did you want to add anything else to the discussion from your previous comments?
I did want to add something. I know they're overlapped, and as we said in an earlier meeting this year, that there's no right or wrong decision. I think there is a perception that the allocation of public funds is highly skewed towards the retail hospitality sector at the detriment of shoe repairers, key cutters, and other businesses that may not have been as glamorous or deemed to be as being able to generate revenue or buzz. But there's also like a lack of data or metrics in relation to like funding the number of funding applications submitted, the total of funds being applied for, the total of people that were rejected or businesses were rejected, and also would like to move towards governments, both local, state and federal, using reviewing their grant allocation methods to use a blind allocation. Public funds should either be distributed equitably and across the board. So if 100 businesses applied, it should be divided up and allocated equally to all businesses, because effectively governments are choosing winners and losers. For businesses that have received tens of thousands of dollars of local and state and federal government support, they're in a lot better situation than businesses that are working in a cultural or a artistic area that have received zero. So I think having a blind allocation for all eligible allocations for public funds should be something that the Melbourne City Council should consider. And having a blind allocation and a set allocation of public funds would allow applications to be simplified, so everyone knows, hey, if I get this grant or this allocation, it's going to be $5,000 or $3,000 or $10,000. They don't have to do budgets. They don't have to do a lot of paperwork. And inversely, the council doesn't have to go through applications, review budgets, review things. It would save a lot more of the precious resources that we do have for all parties, and would help promote a level of transparency and equitable distribution of public funds. Thank you.
Thank you, Wayne. And yes, that sense of fairness and process. I'm going to ask Andrew Weir, who is our director in charge of this part of our business, to give you a response. Thanks.
Thank you, Wayne, for your question. In terms of transparency, all of our grants are published on the City of Melbourne website, so you'll be able to review for every grant program. You'll be able to see all of those recipient companies and form a view yourself as to the distribution of those. Depending on the grant program, awardees were across a variety of categories, not just retail and hospitality. We had a number of programs at the City of Melbourne tackling everything from arts grants recipients, grant programs that supported a wide variety from professional services and services to retail and hospitality, as you allude, but across the whole spectrum of small businesses in the city. And we endeavour to be as transparent as possible in our data. And all of those grants are assessed by a panel independently of council and scored against transparent selection criteria. So I think your feedback is a good one, but I think you'll see quite a bit of additional information on the website. And if you want to get in touch, I'm happy to point you in the right direction. Thanks, Wayne.
Wayne, thanks again for your questions and comments and seeking clarification on those things. And I do know the team would be happy to have a deeper conversation with you if you are up for that. So thank you. We are going to consider the motion that is before us, 6.5. And I'm looking for a councillor to move that motion. Councillor Campbell, thank you. And a councillor to second that motion. Councillor Deutsch, thank you very much. Over to you, Councillor Campbell.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Lord Mayor, at a critical time in our city's history, last year the City of Melbourne implemented a range of initiatives to help our struggling businesses, from grants to business concierge to other support services. It's vital that every dollar we spend has the maximum impact on businesses that have been so hard hit by COVID. That's why the City of Melbourne engaged an independent consultant to survey over 1,000 businesses, made up both of those businesses who received support from the City of Melbourne and those who didn't, because we want to ensure that every dollar we spend, every support we provide, is evidence-based and that it is making a real difference to the businesses that need it most and has the greatest possible impact. For my part, I welcome ongoing feedback from businesses like yours, Wayne, and others, from businesses that missed out and businesses who think we could be doing more or better, because that's what I think we should be striving to do. But I do want to take this moment just to acknowledge the results of that survey of both businesses that received our support and didn't, and the findings of it. And I want to thank our team, because I think it says a lot about the initiatives that they implemented. 89% of the businesses said that the measures implemented by the City of Melbourne had a direct and positive impact. Almost half of the respondents said that the support helped them to keep trading during lockdown last year. And perhaps most eye-opening, 2 in every 5 businesses said they would not still be operating were it not for the support that they received from the City of Melbourne's initiatives. Our team had to mobilise incredibly quickly, and it is remarkable that they have had such an impact. I'm incredibly proud of their efforts, and I want to take this time to thank them for working both so tirelessly and so effectively. But I know there is still so much work to be done. If our businesses are to recover, we need to get visitors and workers back to the city. It cannot be said enough. The research we've done so far will inform the support we provide going forward so that we can make sure that every measure, every dollar we spend delivers maximum impact. I want to say to the businesses and the ratepayers, we are listening. We are making sure we are spending the money in a way that has maximum impact, and to the businesses, we are doing all that we can to ensure your viability. That's why we've extended outdoor dining until the 30th of June. We're revitalising our laneways to create the sort of vibrant city that people want to be in. We've launched the FOMO marketing campaign so that people remember all of the great things that makes Melbourne such a wonderful destination. And we're looking to deliver an enhanced business concierge program, and I look forward to that coming back to FMC if this motion passes next month. But I want to make it clear that the path to economic recovery in Melbourne requires more than just the City of Melbourne. The state government plays a vital role. Its decisions around density limits in restaurants, the return of office workers, and perhaps, in my view, most critically, the return of public servants to city workplaces will make such a significant difference to the recovery of Melbourne CBD, to the pace at which we recover, and to what Melbourne looks like on the other side of this. This motion requests the Lord Mayor to update the Minister for Industry Support and Recovery so that future Victorian Government measures to support the City of Melbourne and bring people back can be properly informed. And for my part, I would strongly encourage the state government to ensure that every public servant returns to his or her city workplace in line with the current thresholds. The City of Melbourne has sought to lead by example in the return of its workers, because we know that every worker back in the city makes a huge difference to our city's businesses. It restores confidence, it revitalises our economy, and it saves jobs. There's no doubt that Melbourne's economy has paid the price disproportionately compared to other cities in this country when it comes to COVID. We need to see every level of government show leadership and use every lever at its disposal if our city's economy is to recover. We know that our businesses are depending on it. That's why I commend this motion.
Thanks, Councillor Campbell. Councillor Deutsch.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Thank you, Councillor Campbell. I'm very glad to be seconding this motion. My first conversation for today actually began with a local cafe owner who was telling me how incredible and helpful the City of Melbourne business concierge team had been throughout COVID. And he was talking to me about how whenever he called the service, he was guaranteed to actually get information and support. And then we had quite a few jokes about, you know, calling our electricity companies and phone companies and how you don't get that same support, and how it was a massive relief for him going through COVID. So that was a really wonderful way to start my day. And I think as well, that's what the Wallace Report really notes, is how valuable the business concierge team was. Just an example of some of the work that's been done in this space. And I think it also noted that 80% of those who accessed the service sought the information that they needed, which is really fantastic, because I don't know about anybody else in this room, but that certainly doesn't help if when I've ever happened for me whenever I call any of my service providers. This Wallace report, I think it's incredibly important for us to be confident in what we're doing. And it's not just for us to be able to pat ourselves on the back for what works, but to understand what isn't working so we can make better decisions going ahead. And I note that the report does mention the city's need to get its workers and visitors back, as Councillor Campbell has spoken to. It's something we've been saying loud and clear for a long time now, and I hope that those who have the power to bring workers and visitors back and those who have the opportunities to do that, see those workers return to the city, also recognise that and the importance it has, and also just how wonderful this city is. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Councillor Deutsch. Are there any other speakers to this motion? Councillor Griffiths.
Thank you, Lord Mayor, and thank you to Councillor Campbell and Councillor Deutsch for the work that they've done, and to everyone from Council who's been working on the programs that are described in the report that we're looking at tonight. I give that thanks both as a councillor who's sitting in the chamber tonight and also as a business owner who received a call from the business concierge last year. And that was nice for a number of reasons, not just because it was nice to think that someone cared, although that genuinely was nice, but also because it gave an opportunity to look up from the daily paperwork and the daily mechanics of running a small business to think about what it was that was still on the bigger picture and what opportunities for support existed. And that wasn't always something that I took the time to do. Perhaps there's a misconception amongst some people that during lockdown, business owners had a whole lot of time just to sit around waiting for customers to return, or perhaps dealing with a smaller number of customers, and so there was plenty of time. Obviously, the reverse of that is actually true. It was such a dynamic, changing and confronting environment. It seemed that there were weekly, if not daily, changes to the rules that we were operating under. And there was so much uncertainty about the future that it was easy to be overwhelmed. And so to receive some contact and have that little break was a very important opportunity. I've spoken there about things as though they're in the past tense, but of course we know that that uncertainty remains, and that businesses continue to need support and a very high level of support. So it's fantastic to see that there are a number of new ideas and new initiatives that we'll be considering at future meetings to continue that good work. So in thanking everyone who's already done the work, I'd also like to thank everyone who's going to have to do the work that will arise out of this motion in advance, and recognise that there's a sense of urgency in it, and a sense of what I might call determined optimism about what it is that we think can be achieved. And for those reasons, thank you for everything that's happened so far, and thank you for the work that will be done in the future. I commend the motion.
Thanks, Councillor Griffiths. Councillors, are there any other speakers to this motion? Councillor Lillu.
Thank you, Lord Mayor, and it was a really interesting and insightful report, and it gives a good indication of the work that we have been doing. But nevertheless, I think we also need to acknowledge that the support and grant, it's limited in what we can do because there is a cost to it. There is an amount that we have, and we, yes, we are a capital city, and we are the biggest in Victoria, but there are other things that we also need to deliver for our community, but also at the same time, you know, we have a very shrinking budget, and I think for us, you know, there's only so much we can do, and if we keep on experiencing things, look, for me, I really want to just highlight, you know, the fact that we need to have confidence. You know, the snap lockdown over the week, over the what is one of the biggest period, is for me really, really difficult and hard. And I think for us, we really need to, I guess, you know, stand up for our many stakeholders, the people within our city, to actually say it's not just sometimes the money that, or the kind of the grants and, you know, things like that that is needed. It's actually the confidence to be able to order food and the stock for next few weeks, knowing that it's not gonna, we're not gonna go straight into a lockdown for a week. That for me is more important than, you know, a few thousand dollars or anything. And so in that sense, I'd be very keen to, rather than making decisions in kind of a cabinet and also in, you know, very political sense, rather include business and industry leaders to, in those decision making, because, you know, it would be very easy. Someone could be able to tell you, hey, look, you know, this is what it means if we actually make this decision. Because I think sometimes as politicians, you know, it's been a long, long time since I've operated a small business. You know, sometimes we tend to forget the hurt and, you know, how our decision influenced someone's lives. And I think that is something that we really need to take for. So, but again, this report really highlights the fact that, you know, we have been doing what we can. We've supported a lot of people. We will continue to do so. But I just make the point that, you know, there's only a certain limited things we can do. And if we keep on going with unexpected lockdowns and everything, yeah, we're really going to struggle to deliver those for our constituents.
Thank you, Councillor Lillu. Any other speakers to this motion? Then I'm going to put the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. It's unanimous, so we declare that motion carried. Thank you, councillors. Well, this concludes reports from management this evening. There is an item of general business for consideration in this session. It's item 7.1, notice of motion. Councillor Philip Lillu, Anzac Day Parade. I'm calling on Councillor Lillu to move the motion as it is on the screen. Thank you. And I'm calling on Councillor Chang to second the motion. Thank you, Councillor Chang. Over to you, Councillor Lillu.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. And first and foremost, I want to thank Councillor Chang for supporting it, but also fellow councillors and Lord Mayor, and for the input and the ideas. Look, the motion is very simple, and look, we seek to, this motion seeks to reinforce City of Melbourne's desire to see the parade proceed and reaffirms that Council's assistance and guidance alongside the state government will continue to be provided to ensure the parade proceeds in a safely and successful manner. Anzac Day Parade is a very important part of Melbourne, and given the cancellations last year of the parade, it will be heartbreaking if it doesn't go ahead again this year. For me, it's quite personal. I've marched in it ever since we were invited to march, and I've gotten to know many of the veterans over those times, and also at the same time, it's, you know, those people. It was those people who've who I've approached to get this kind of feedback and also to see what support we can actually do. You know, I've always enjoyed hearing the stories, but also it's the on the day it's a very emotional one, and it's a tradition that I think we always celebrate and respect a lot of the heroes, like in Moomba we've picked the front workers to celebrate, and again I think this is a fair way to help recognise and promote that. I also want to note the many names on the wall of in the town hall entrance that have actually served in the war, and we pay tribute to that because I think it's quite important. But finally, look, I recognise a lot of good work that has gone into this, and I note the positive progress that has come out of it. I was hoping I didn't really have to put anything through 2 weeks ago when I circulated this, but at the same time, we still haven't got a decision. So this is more to ensure that, hope that, this to throw our weight and support to it. I'm sure everyone's working behind the scenes to get more, to get this over the board. But for me, this is something I really want to put forward to the commit City of Melbourne to demonstrate to our veterans, to the people who've marched in this parade, that, City of Melbourne behind you, and also throw our support to RSL and also the state government to ensure that we are doing everything we can. I hope that announcement is imminent so that the veterans and their families and supporters can have that peace of mind to know that what is happening around Anzac Day Parade.
Thank you, Councillor Cheng.
Thank you, Councillor Liu, for putting forward this motion. I remember when I was a 15-year-old boy at high school and in the Army Cadets, marching down St Kilda Road in my Army Cadet uniform and standing at attention, hearing the last post. So for me, this is also personal. I remember seeing all these heroes and veterans who served in the war, who sacrificed themselves to give us this great country that we all live in. So I'm so proud and honoured to second this motion. I think this shows the support that the City of Melbourne will throw behind the parade. And it gives our children also the ability to see these veterans who, may not have very long left as well, unfortunately. And I want my daughter to sort of remember the sacrifices made by these veterans. So I'm proud and honoured to second this motion and throw my full heart behind it.
Thank you, Councillor Cheng. Are there any other speakers to this motion? Then I'm going to put the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. It's unanimous, so we declare that motion carried. Thank you, Councillor Leleu and Councillor Cheng. This brings us to the end of general business to be considered in open session this evening. There is an item of urgent business, and I would like to move the recommendation that it be considered as urgent business. I'm looking for a seconder to that. Thank you, Deputy Lord Mayor. Speaking to the urgency of the item, I note that the Commonwealth Government tourism support package has come up or has arisen since the agenda came out for this meeting, which meant that we couldn't otherwise put it on as an item of general business. It is important that we address it in a timely manner, given that the Commonwealth Government is considering any updates to that program at the moment. So for those reasons, I support the fact that it's an urgent item of business. Over to you, Deputy Lord Mayor.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. I also support it as an urgent item of business for all the reasons you outlined, plus the fact that, of course, the JobKeeper support for the City of Melbourne and elsewhere is due to expire on the 31st of March, making a matter like this even more critical for the city.
Excellent, thank you. Are there any other speakers to the urgent nature of this item? Councillor Liu.
Sorry, Lord Mayor, I'm not sure if I should declare my conflict here or in the next one.
Probably when we're looking at the substantive. Okay. Looking to our governance experts to advise on this.
Councillor Leloup has a conflict in this. What we're doing here is admitting an item in.
So when we get to the next motion, we're going to come to that. Yep, good. Thank you for clarifying that. Then are there any other speakers to the urgent nature of this item? Nope. Then we're going to put this to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. Unanimous. Great. Thank you. So that motion is carried. We're going to consider the substantive, and Councillor Leloup.
I'd like to declare conflict of duty as I'm a director in an aviation startup.
Thanks, Councillor Leloup. Good. Well, let's have a look at that motion. Thanks, Jody. I'm calling on a councillor to move the motion as it appears on the screen. Councillor Campbell, thank you, and a councillor to second the motion. Councillor Deutsch, thanks. Over to you, Councillor Campbell.
Thank you. I strongly welcome the federal government's $1.2 billion tourism package, which encourages Australians to holiday interstate by offering 800,000 half-price tickets. With our international borders effectively shut, domestic tourism is vital to keep the industry alive. And here in Melbourne, we want our share. More importantly, we need it. Like the rest of Australia, we have witnessed the decimation of international tourism markets and experienced the uncertainty of border closures. But after over 100 days of lockdown here in Victoria, our tourism industry has done it particularly tough, and Melbourne in particular has been disproportionately impacted by the economic consequences of COVID. With forecast losses of $110 billion over the next 5 years and up to 79,000 jobs to be lost. Tourism is one of the City of Melbourne's most impacted sectors due to the pandemic, with estimated losses of 23,000 jobs to date. Late last year, tourism spending in the City of Melbourne was down 91% from the previous year. It's not all doom and gloom. Melbourne is open for business, but it cannot afford to miss out at this critical time of its share of this package, which currently subsidises Victorians to fly to 11 interstate destinations, but subsidises no flights into Tullamarine, the most direct gateway into Melbourne. Compared to 11 routes out of Victoria, there are only two subsidised routes in, and both land in Avalon. Given the disproportionate impact of COVID on Melbourne's economy, we need more passengers to be incentivised to travel to Victoria, and we need every tourist arriving in Victoria to holiday in Melbourne, to enjoy the world's best restaurants, bars, galleries and theatres, the things we've missed so much due to lockdowns and COVID and restrictions. It's important to note the timing of this package. It comes at such a critical time. The subsidised flights are due to start in April, straight after the end of JobKeeper. In Victoria, it is the workers of Melbourne who are most exposed to the end of JobKeeper. And further within Melbourne industries, KPMG reports that JobKeeper has been widely used by the industries that are linked to tourism, including hospitality and retail. Targeted relief like the federal government's tourism package is vital to our tourism industry getting back on its feet. Every passenger that lands in Melbourne helps our businesses stay open. It helps them keep on workers, and it's vital if we're to start creating jobs. Subsidising more routes into Victoria, including flights into Tullamarine Airport, sends a clear message. It incentivises Australians to choose Melbourne as their holiday destination and provides a vital boost to an industry that desperately needs it. I welcome the federal government reviewing its destination list following the announcement of this $1.2 billion package. I note that Hobart was added yesterday, and Townsville earlier this week. And I say it's Melbourne's turn. That's why I commend this motion.
Thank you, Councillor Campbell. Councillor Deutsch.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Thank you, Councillor Campbell. Thank you very much for this motion as well. The Commonwealth Government's decision to not include Melbourne's Tullamarine Airport as a destination for the support package, I think it's kind of incredible and I don't mean like in a good way incredible, I'm just trying not to be rude. 10 flights taking people away from Melbourne and then only two routes into Avalon. It doesn't make a lot of sense if this package is to truly support the tourism industry, especially those areas hit hardest by the pandemic. I've heard the federal government spokespeople explain that this package was targeted at tourism areas which were usually serviced by international tourists. But when I applied that logic to the routes provided, it kind of then argues that Burnie has a higher international profile than Melbourne. And I mean, I didn't bother doing any stats there. I just went off some assumptions that I think Melbourne also has a very valuable international tourist destination. So again, I'm definitely not having a shot at Burnie. I believe Tasmania's third largest city, which I'm 99% sure it is great, but Melbourne should be there as well. And conversations I've had with many city traders, especially those in Chinatown and Block Arcade, you know, have spoken about the importance of international tourism to the value of their businesses. So if that's true, then Melbourne should definitely be included as a destination. So thank you to Councillor Campbell again for bringing this motion of urgent business forward. I'm proud to be seconding it. Thank you.
Thanks, Councillor Doidge. Any other speakers to this motion? Councillor Griffiths?
Thank you, Lord Mayor, and thank you again to Councillor Campbell and Councillor Doidge for their work on advocating for the city and for the support for the businesses in the city. I might just start by noting on a positive note that the last time we were sitting in this chamber, we were requesting the Lord Mayor to go to the state government and ask for free public transport for the Labor Day Moomba long weekend. I think you, Lord Mayor, might have had 2 days to undertake that advocacy, and you were successful in doing so. So congratulations and thank you to you on doing that work. And, of course, thank you to the state government for helping to contribute to what was an amazing weekend in the city, one that was valued, I know, by so many people who are operating businesses in the city. We've heard tonight on a number of motions about initiatives from the council to address the city's recovery from COVID. I think it's fair to say that we're doing absolutely everything that we can to revive the city, reactivate the city and make it a place where businesses can thrive and workers can return and have their jobs. At the same time as thinking about that, we know that the federal government has chosen to end the JobKeeper supplement on the 31st of March. And we know from information that was provided on one of the earlier motions that 80 to 90% of the businesses in the City of Melbourne were receiving JobKeeper in December. Councillor Campbell mentioned a vast array of statistics that paint a picture of the kind of stress that Melbourne businesses have been under. We know that Melbourne is the most affected city in the most affected state in Australia. It had seemed reasonable, therefore, that when the federal government was sitting down to start planning what was going to happen after JobKeeper, that they might go through the list and examine which places were the most affected and addressed those areas that were worst affected first. Well, whatever process was undertaken, it doesn't feel like it was the one that I just described. It feels, as we've just heard about additional places being added to this program, that Melbourne is at best an afterthought, or given those other places have been added since the program was initially announced, an afterthought of an afterthought. And we know for the businesses in Melbourne, for the people who work in those businesses, and by extension the residents, that Melbourne can't be an afterthought. It can't be an afterthought in the state government's approach to rebuilding after COVID-19, and it can't be an afterthought in the federal government's approach to rebuilding after COVID-19. Let me return to that positive note that I started on, and also of that note of determined optimism that I mentioned in a previous motion. I commend this motion. I think it is a well thought out and well written motion, and I truly hope that the Lord Mayor is as effective in her advocacy on this matter as she was in regards to public transport.
Thanks, Councillor Griffiths. Any other speakers to this motion? Councillor Rees, Deputy Lord Mayor.
Thanks very much, Lord Mayor. As is well known to councillors and has been mentioned this evening, the city of Melbourne and central Melbourne has been the hardest hit region of Australia as a result of the COVID economic downturn. And it is true that we have seen some very positive signs of recovery in our central city economy in recent times, but it is also the absolute fact that we have a long, long way still to go. One of the important measures of economic activity in the central city is our pedestrian footfall data, which we all now follow religiously on a daily basis. And I can report to FMC that today's figures show that pedestrian footfall in the central city is at 56% of what it was pre-COVID. Or to put that another way, pedestrian activity in Melbourne is 44% lower than where it was before COVID-19. Now, compare that to the national economic contraction that we've seen as a result of COVID-19. Over the year to September 2020, the Australian economy contracted by 3.8%, and that contraction of 3.8% prompted the federal government to introduce a range of measures, including JobKeeper, which I, for one, I think was an absolutely excellent and brave move by the federal government. But again, I make the point, JobKeeper came off the back of a 3.8% contraction in our economy, national economy. We're sitting here today knowing that pedestrian activity, great measure of economic activity here in the city of Melbourne, is 44% down on where it was pre-COVID. And yet we're sitting here tonight, we are staring down the barrel of JobKeeper being removed in just on 2 weeks from now. So it's against that backdrop that we find that in 2 weeks from now, we're about to have a vital prop of our central city economy pulled from under us. And then the very next day, we have a new initiative starting, the half-price flights initiative by the Commonwealth Government, which will then provide an active incentive for people to leave Melbourne and go elsewhere. So on one day, the 31st of March, we have an economic prop kicked from under us. The next day, we have an incentive provided for more people to leave our town. That is an act of that will cause great economic detriment to Melbourne. Now, I know Dan Tehan is a proud Victorian, and at this time, I think we all would be calling on him to lend us a helping hand by extending the this flights scheme to include Melbourne. So give us a helping hand, not make a bad situation worse. And to Josh Frydenberg, who, of course, is the Commonwealth Deputy Liberal Leader, the most senior Victorian Liberal. I think the question for Josh is, does he want to be a hometown hero or a person who abandoned us during our hour of greatest need? So I'm very pleased to be able to support this motion. I hope that we can extend these flight subsidies to include Melbourne, and I do hope that JobKeeper or some form of JobKeeper, perhaps a more targeted JobKeeper, can be provided to Melbourne after the 31st of March.
Thanks, Deputy Lord Mayor. Any other speakers to the motion? I'm going to speak to the motion before we consider the vote, of course, and we'll be adding my voice to the chorus, but it's such an important issue. It deserves to be said over and over and over again. Of course, we welcome the Tourism Aviation Network Support Scheme announced by the federal government. It's at a time when we need to build confidence for people to fly again. That's really important. I know that there are many discounted flights coming into the market at the moment, but the strength of the voice and the actions of the federal government and the activity that federal government programs generate are so significant that it is important that we look to the federal government to make sure that they are signalling to the rest of Australia their support for the most impacted city municipality in Australia, and that's right here in the city of Melbourne. the federal government program comes at a good time to encourage people to fly, because that will drive here in Victoria tourism, business confidence and jobs. It comes at a good time to support businesses that are in the sectors that will feel the brunt of the ending of the JobKeeper program on the 31st of March. We need our fair share of visitors. That is the fair share of visitors given the impact that we've experienced here in the city of Melbourne. Under the current scheme, as many of my councillor colleagues have pointed out, there is more opportunities for Victorians to leave our state than there are for people from other states to visit our city. We need the federal government to consider that the program at the moment supports visitors from two destinations only, compared to Victorians and Melburnians considering 11 destinations to fly to. We are calling on the Commonwealth Government to expand the discounted flight routes to ensure that more Australians can afford to come to Melbourne. That is what's fair. We are looking to the federal government to deliver more discounted flights to Melbourne so that our economy starts flying again. For those reasons, I am supporting the motion. I'm looking to see if there are any other speakers need for a right to reply. No, then I'm putting the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. It's unanimous. So we can declare that motion carried. Thank you, councillors. That was the last item for consideration this evening. I'm advising everybody that there are no other questions for consideration in the public question time. And so we can say thank you to everyone who's participated and prepared for the meeting this evening. And we're declaring the meeting closed at 8 p.m. Very tidy. Thank you.
If you're still with us, that's the end of the meeting. Everyone...